12 meetings in order. Okay. Administrative hearings of the first account.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Raymond R. Krause, the Chief Judge of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And with your permission today, I'd like to do two things. First, I have a short presentation for the members of the committee on background of what the OAH is and how it operates. And second, I'll briefly address the budget as submitted by the governor. The Office of Administrative Hearings is an independent central panel administrative hearing office as part of the executive branch. It's established by this legislature in 1976. Central panel offices conduct hearings for other state agencies rather than having the agencies employ their own hearing officers. And that is a practice that the legislature believed would improve the transparency and fairness of the hearing process. Our office was actually the fifth central panel established in the country, and now 27 states, the District of Columbia, and the cities of New York and Chicago have all established central panel hearing offices. The Office of Administrative Hearings has two divisions, an Administrative Law Division and a Workers' Compensation Division, and I will address the Ad Law Division first. The Administrative Law Division employs 9 Administrative Law Judges, or ALJs, including the Assistant Chief Bruce Johnson and myself. Both of us maintain active administrative law dockets as well as our administrative roles. The administrative law caseload has 5 major components. First is when the state agencies take adverse regulatory or other actions against citizens and businesses, the principles of due process require that they have an opportunity for a hearing to appeal those actions. Our ALJs conduct those hearings as a contested case under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 14. The OAH currently conducts a variety of types of administrative hearings for over 80 state agencies. The agencies that are largest in terms of hours spent are the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Education. Second, the division's role in the state rulemaking process. By law, we exercise oversight over the rulemaking by state agencies to ensure that they follow the law and the legislature's directives when adopting rules. Third, we also conduct hearings under a contract for a number of Minnesota cities and counties. In the past 5 years, our ALJs have conducted administrative hearings for over 40 different political subdivisions. For example, we conduct most of the administrative hearings for the city of St. Paul, the personnel and licensure hearings for the city of Minneapolis, and most of the hearings for Hennepin County. Fourth, in 2004, legislation was enacted creating an administrative remedy for violations of the Fair Campaign Practices Act, and violations were previously investigated by county attorneys, which took their time away from prosecution of other crimes. Now the division's ALJs hear and make final decisions on administrative complaints alleging violations of the Act. We received 21 campaign cases in 2006 and so far have received 50 complaints during this fiscal year. Fifth, the Office of Administrative Hearings rules allow parties to request the Chief Administrative Law Judge to assign administrative law judges to mediate disputes between parties of a contested case. Several agencies have begun to refer matters to OAH for mediation even before contested cases are filed as a cost-effective alternative to litigation. In 2006, the division conducted 560 administrative hearing and rulemaking proceedings. In 2005, the governor issued a reorganization order transferring the functions, powers, and duties of the state's Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit from the Department of Administration to the Office of Administrative Hearings. The Division's Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group is responsible under Chapter 414 for receiving and reviewing all orderly annexation agreements and all petitions for municipal annexation, detachment, and incorporation. In 2006, the unit issued orders making 378 adjustments to the boundaries of the state cities, totaling 56,469 acres in 62 different counties. From a budget perspective, the Administrative Law Division operates like a private law firm. We charge state and local agencies by the hour for the time our ALJs and staff attorneys actually spend on their cases. The revenues that OAH collects from state and local agencies are deposited in a special revenue revolving fund, which is directly appropriated to OAH by statute to pay the Administrative Law Division's operational costs. In short, when the Administrative Law Division budget is financially self-regulated, when business increases, we add staff, and like private businesses, when business declines, we have to make cuts in order to keep our revolving fund in balance. To minimize the fluctuations of our business flow, we have employed four contract judges who are assigned cases as needed, but who add no residual cost when the demand doesn't require their use. We currently charge agencies an hourly rate of $160 per hour for ALJ time and $80 per hour for staff attorney time. As comparison, in 2004, which is the last year for which we have data, the statewide average for billing rates of attorneys in private practice was $295 for partners and $191 for associates. Those rates fluctuate from area to area within the state, but by any measure, we think the division's rates are significantly lower than those charged by attorneys with comparable credentials, expertise, and experience. The division's revolving fund revenues were $1,608,000 in fiscal year 2006, but are projected to increase by 20% in 2007. The major reason for the increase is additional hearing activity for the Public Utilities Commission. In April of 2006, the PUC staff indicated that during 2007, the Commission would be referring to OAH 30 major energy and telecommunications cases and 12 minor cases and either two or three major rulemaking procedures. So that really accounts for the largest part of the revolving fund increase expected for this year, revenue increase. In addition to the revolving fund revenues, the Ad Law Division receives two relatively small appropriations. First is a general fund appropriation to fund the work of the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Unit. That appropriation is $262,000 for the current fiscal year, and the governor is recommending a $19,000 increase for FY 2008 and a $22,000 increase for fiscal year 2009. Those changes represent increases for the cost of compensation and for the increase in rent that will occur when the unit moves from the Centennial Building to the Stassi Building next September. And just make an aside, at this point, the Office of Administrative Hearings is also moving. We are moving from private space in Minneapolis to the Stassi Building here in the Capitol Complex. And that will also result in a significant budget decrease. We will be saving about $400,000 per year in rent by that move. In addition to that, we are experiencing some really exceptional shared services savings by partnering with the Department of Revenue, who is the major tenant in the Stassi Building, and sharing various overhead staff services between the two agencies. So we will have additional savings there. But the rent differential for the Municipal Boundary Adjustments Group between Centennial and Stassi needs that small adjustment. Finally, the division has been receiving a $65,000 appropriation from the General Fund Appropriation to the account of the State Elections Campaign Fund, and that appropriation is essentially in the nature of a retainer against which we bill for those campaign cases that I mentioned earlier under the Fair Campaign Practices Act. In an off-year election, our billings are much lower, as you might expect. Last year, it was about $13,000 spent out of the $65,000, and $52,000 was returned to the campaign fund. So far this fiscal year, which was an on-year election, if you will, we have charged about $52,000 and are returning about $12,000 to the campaign fund. The second division of the OAH is the Workers' Compensation Division, and the Workers' Compensation Division consists of 25 judges plus support personnel, and of those judges, 23 are here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and there are two judges in our office in Duluth. Besides the hearing judge in Duluth, the judges here in the metro area travel at least 1 week per month to conduct hearings at our various hub locations, such as Walker, Worthington, Owatonna, Mankato, Fergus Falls, and Crookston. The primary mission of the Workers' Compensation Division is the adjudication of all workers' comp disputes in the state of Minnesota, and that takes place in two different ways. First is the Settlement Division, which provides informal, non-evidentiary types of conferences, and this is the primary area that is being addressed in our request for one additional judge in the governor's recommendation. In our Settlement Division, we conduct settlement conferences. We conduct what are called 239 hearings and 106 hearings. The 239 conferences are where an insurer is attempting to stop payment of benefits, and the 106 conferences deal with disputed medical bills over $1,500. When cases can't be settled, the parties affected by the 239 conference or the 106 conference get a formal hearing, and those formal hearings go up to the hearing division, and so everything that can be settled obviously helps us reduce the burden on the hearing division, which is a more costly procedure than the settlement procedure. The hearing division, as I said, is where the cases are tried and a formal evidentiary record is made. These decisions are final decisions and can be appealed to the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals. The legislative directive we've had in the past years is to try to get all of those hearings set within 6 months of their certification to the hearing division, and we are meeting that objective. The governor, however, recommends increasing the staff of the Office of Administrative Hearings Workers' Comp Division by one judge at a cost of $133,000 per fiscal year, and that is for the settlement division. Because in the settlement division, we are not meeting the goals that we've set for ourselves. We have had a 33% reduction in staff from 1997 to 2004, and while the hearing activity has remained relatively flat, the settlement disputes, the number of disputes coming into the settlement division has actually gone up significantly. According to the Minnesota Workers' Comp System report for 2004, quote, after a period of stability from 97 to 99, the dispute rate rose sharply from 1999 to 2004. That extra workload, in combination with the decrease in the number of judges that we've experienced in the past few years, has pushed out the time it takes to get a decision out from the settlement division on the 239 cases from 2.7 days to 3.6, and more importantly, from the 106 cases from 9.8 days to 20.8 days. And we feel that is too long for the injured worker and the employer's insurance company to have to wait to get a resolution. We have tried a number of methods to bring down that time. We have tried to shift judges from the hearing division to the settlement division. And it's kind of like Jell-O. You squirt out the other end. If you take hearing judges away and put them in settlement division, we start to lose our six-month target on the hearing division. We have now been triple-setting our judges. In other words, each judge in the settlement division is assigned three cases to work on each hour. And as you can well imagine, the effectiveness of a judge trying to keep all those balls in the air and settle three cases at the same time is less effective than if they were doing one or two. And our settlement rates reflect the fact that this is stretching the effectiveness of our judges. So we have made the request, and as I say, the governor is part of, is included in his recommendation, the request for one additional judge for the Workers' Compensation Settlement Division. The salary, including benefits, as I mentioned, was $133,000, and that portion of the Workers' Comp Special Compensation Fund budget set aside to administer workers' compensation is $10,221,000, which means the salary that this extra judge would be, the cost of that salary would be 0.01% increase in the total workers' comp budget. So we think it is a modest request given the time pressures and our legislative imperative to get those cases resolved for the injured workers as quickly as we can.
Judge Press, can I ask what's the status of the workers' comp fund? Is it in robust financial health?
It is, as far as I know. That is administered by the Department of Labor and Industry. And in my conversations with Commissioner Brenner, I understand that the workers' comp fund is in very good shape. I don't think they anticipate, I really shouldn't speak for Commissioner Brenner, but I'm not aware of any increase that he has asked for additional funds for the special comp fund. I believe it is in good shape.
Okay. Any questions?
Chair, if I could real quickly, I think I understand most of the work and most of the decisions you do, but I, if you would refer to page 3, the additional hearing activity you're going to have this year from the PUC. I'm not quite understanding the PUC role or responsibility. Why are they not making a decision without on these contested hearings and these things without involving OAH to recommend to them to make that decision? Tell me about the process. I'm wondering if it isn't, is the PUC just pushing off a decision for you for recommendation and then getting that recommendation to make a decision?
Madam Chair, Representative Twigger, the way that process works is the Public Affiliates Commission has the ability to hold its own hearings. However, they have found that it's more cost-effective for them to have us hold their hearings because, again, it's one judge rather than that whole Public Utilities Commission holding the hearing. They've also found that it is create a better, more thorough record by doing it this way that is more helpful on appeals. And so we have been conducting some of their hearings for a number of years and most of their hearings in recent years because they found it's more cost effective for them to hire us to do those hearings than to do them themselves. And what we do is we hold the hearing, depending on the kind of Public Utilities Commission matter that it is, we either just hold, for example, I just did one out in Dawson, Minnesota, where it was just to hold the public hearing and provide the commission with the results of that public hearing, the information coming in, with no recommendation or anything else. It was just rather send one ALJ out to Dawson rather than taking the whole Public Utilities Commission out there. It was more cost-effective to do that. In some of the decisions, what we do is we make a recommended decision based on information we get from the hearings that we hold, and they still retain the final decision-making authority.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, just want to follow up, Judge Krause. Obviously, that process would abrogate some of the live Q&A that, say, the PUC would have an opportunity to do. Am I to understand that the PUC then just reviews the record as it is, or do they, from time to time, will they request an additional hearing to supplement their needed findings?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, they have that ability to do that, and it's their choice to, if they wish to supplement the record with other hearings before that, and I believe they do from time to time, but again, for particularly routine matters, it's their view that it's more cost-effective to have us hold these hearings for them.
Judge Krause, are there other places in state government where that might hold true? There's somebody holding hearings that might be more cost-effective for you to do it, and no one's thought of it?
Madam Chair, at the risk of looking like I'm trying to drum up business,
no.
I think there are. If you look at the central panels that other states have,
okay,
and what their jurisdiction includes, there are a number of areas that we do not do that other states do. Unemployment compensation is one. The implied consent hearings with the driver's license. 23 states have administrative law judges doing those rather than judicial branch judges, which they have found is a successful way of reducing the amount of caseload on judicial branch. There are a number of I think Human Services has some hearing officers that hold hearings as well in certain areas. There are a number of areas that we don't have jurisdiction over that many other states do, and that's always something we're open to discussing. But I think there are some opportunities to give a short answer to your question. I think there are some opportunities in this state to do some more centralizing of that hearing function. The more you do, the more cost-effective it gets.
This might be something that it's worth, obviously not in the course of just this hearing, that it's worth looking into in terms of it might be something that the Legislative Audit Commission ought to look at, or it might be something. I don't know what kind of process we have for throwing what might be a good idea or might be an idea that ought to be eliminated out into the stratosphere and having it bump around and come back. So I don't know if anyone has any thoughts. Representative Horton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question. Are those implied consent hearings right now in the normal court system, or is there another administrative system somewhere else handling the implied consent?
Madam Chair, Representative, those are now being handled by district court judges in the judicial branch, regular district court system.
Well,
in this state.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the way we put these ideas out there is in bill form, and so maybe, and I know that the courts are really struggling with their caseload. This sounds like a good area to look at whether we can more efficiently handle it somewhere else.
I think one of the things that maybe you could ask, without understanding that you're only, Judge Krause, you're only responding to this question because it was asked of you, let the record show. But maybe you could give us some kind of a list of the things and other, if that's the kind of thing that you have, you may be the easiest person for us to get it from. Things that other states are doing centrally and things, and, you know, other complaints about this. I mean, for example, how many of the PUC cases get, you know, are they more easily done there, or does it mean that a certain number have to be redone, and are there complaints from people who are saying that they're not getting the proper hearing?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to provide that to the committee. We can very easily do that.
Okay. Great. Any other? Thank you, Representative Chigley, for pointing that out. Any other questions of Judge Krause? Okay. Any other? Anything else you want to say to us?
Madam Chair.
Oh. Representative Winkler.
Madam Chair, Judge Krause, and I'm sorry if I missed it, but are you moving to a system of electronic filings of your administrative decisions?
Madam Chair, Representative.
As a former litigator in some of those courts and having to do the research, that would certainly aid the legal community.
Thank you for asking that question. We are. Matter of fact, our first deep foray into that area is with the Public Utilities Commission because, as you can well imagine, in a large rate-making case, we could almost fill up this hearing room with the boxes of documents in a large rate-making case or a line transmission case. And what we have now successfully partnered with the PUC on is an electronic filing system that is sort of the guinea pig, if you will. And we are now, I think three or four cases that are completely electronic filing. There are no papers other than a few individuals, public citizens that have sent in paper things that we have had to scan in. But other than that, it's all electronic file, and that's going very well. We hope to use that as a model to migrate that technology into the rest of our cases so that we can have e-filing become more of a regular process with OAH. The other piece in the other division, the workers' comp division, which is also a very has been a paper-intensive entity, we are working with the Department of Labor to get away from their existing imaging system where right now, for example, an insurance company that is already electronically keeping track of its insured has to print out something, send it to Dolly so that Dolly can image it and make it electronic and send it to us electronically. We want to go to a system that is completely electronic so that you don't have to create paper so that you can make it electronic later. And so we're partnering with them to do that as well. So we're really trying to do that in our biggest two areas, figuring that if we're successful there, it's going to be easier enough to migrate that to smaller areas.
Madam Chair, one follow-up question. And what about the decisions of the ALJ or the administrative law judges, past and future? Are they going to be available for free online, much like the Office of the Department of Administration does for their data privacy decisions?
Madam Chair, Representative, they already are. All of our administrative law division cases are online. And we just this year innovated a new thing because, again, most of our decisions are recommended decisions as opposed to final decisions. The agency still retains the right to make the final decision. What we have put into the system this year is a link so that when you go to the OAH website and you get into our database, which is a very handy, easily searchable, word searchable database, you can go to that ALJ decision. And there'll be a link up at the top that you can click on to get to the agency's final order, because they sometimes do not take our recommendations. Can't imagine, but they don't. And so you can, for the first time, actually link the two. And so an attorney looking at a case for precedential value or whatever can not only find out what the ALJ decided and recommended, but then can see if the commissioner of that agency went along with it or not, and why. So that the workers' compensation division is not yet online, but we are, again, working with the Department of Labor because we're pretty much tied at the hip to them because of the imaging system to get those online and available as well. But that is lagging behind because we have to wait for the imaging system.
Thank you from me and from junior associates everywhere.
Madam Chair, if I might, I would like to close with one thank you to this committee, as I did to the Senate committee, for the past support for our move to the Stassen building. We think that it's going to be a really good move for us and for the state, and for those of you who were on this committee before and supported that, my thanks for that. I think it's going to work out very well.
Another
one of the things that we were talking about before with the idea of having better tabs on real estate management, that maybe that would make us able to, or anybody able to look for more things like that that should be done. So, any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you
very much. Just to clarify it, I think I know this. All department rules hearings go through you, don't they? Or only contested cases? Whether
no, ma'am. Madam Chair, all rulemaking hearings go through our office, yes. Correct.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay. We do have a quorum, and the minutes are before us, and Representative Anderson moves the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are adopted. Okay. Next is the CAC Board. I've been told that this committee was, maybe because we did it first and it was one of our first activities, I've been told that this committee was much nicer during the tour of the Capitol than the next committee was.
Yes, Madam
more
Chair.
More subdued and...
Thank you.
Appreciative.
Yes, Madam Chair. I do think this committee had a number of very interesting questions and very attentive members, so we do thank you. May I introduce myself? I am Nancy Stark, Executive Secretary of the CAP Board, and I have Paul Mandel with me today. Paul is our Principal Planner and our Zoning Administrator for the Board. I'd like to go over just briefly a little bit of who we are and what we do for the new members of your committee, and then to go into a brief discussion about our base budget, and then to outline for you the three budget initiatives that we brought forward this fall to the Department of Finance for the governor's consideration. For some of you who may not know, the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, we were created in 1967 by the legislature as a small non-cabinet agency with great responsibility and oversight in the Capital District. Per Minnesota Statute 15B, our mission is to preserve the historical and architectural integrity of the Capital Area. We administer all zoning and design rules for a 60-block area in and around the Capital. And through the Board's comprehensive plan, establish a flexible framework for growth of the Capital Complex buildings, all in keeping with the original design of Cass Gilbert, the architect of our magnificent Capitol. The agency consists of a staff of four, an architect, a planner, a fiscal officer, and an administrative assistant. We service a board of 10, including two legislators. We have three architectural advisors and are chaired by the lieutenant governor. And the governor appoints four of our board members, and the mayor of St. Paul appoints three of our board members, one being from the district that we serve. We also have the pleasure of Representative Mary Liz Holberg serving on our board. This biennium, we've been involved in many varying projects. We've heard over 100 zoning issues. We have issued zoning permits for three state new office buildings, parking structures, and various residential and commercial development within the district. We have four new memorials underway in all phases of design and construction. And I would add that just this week, Paul and I were asked to approve some of the final design features for the World War II Memorial, which will be completed this spring on the base of the Capitol Mall. We are serving as co-chairs of district task forces, namely the Central Corridor as it passes through our district, as well as the LRT, and the downtown development strategy. Since 2001, we have been involved with the Capital 2005 Commission. We coordinated and did all of their administrative activities up and through part of fiscal 2006. And as always, we are collaborators with the Department of Administration and the Historical Society on the restoration of the Minnesota State Capitol. During all this work, the CAP Board has operated as a part-time agency for the state of Minnesota. Now I'd like to focus on the base budget history and to bring you up to date. In fiscal year 2003, the CAP Board's budget was reduced by 24%. In response, the Board, unwilling to compromise its mission and service to the public, immediately reduced its employee salaries between 10 and 20% to maintain operations of the agency, and also the 15-member unfunded, I might add, Capital 2005 Centennial Commission. As the CAP Board has no special programs, grant sources, or permanent revenue initiatives, the agency had to absorb the 24% reduction through its salary base. And consequently, the CAP Board has operated as a part-time state agency for the last two biennia. As a small, non-cabinet agency, the Board does not have the flexibility of a large cabinet agency's budget. Therefore, the current budget allocates 80% for staff funded at only 80 to 90% of our time, depending, and this is why we had to be flexible about the 80 to 90%. It was all dependent on operational expenses, rent increases, step increases, insurance, and projects requiring board action. Now I will ask that you turn to the second page, which is the chart that we have in our handout. We have listed there for you three items which we were calling budget initiatives. The first item is probably the most important in that we are requesting an adjustment to the agency's base budget in the amount of $110,000 per year, for a total of $220,000 for the biennium. You may ask, what will this change bring to the agency and the adjustment to our base? It will restore office operating hours. It will restore the number of board and advisor meetings by at least 50%. It will restore budgeted monies for our advisors to review projects and agency policy initiatives per our statute. It will also assist us in restoring and replenishing our office equipment, the systems and the servicing and the maintenance of that. Another very important thing for us is the updating of our planning tools, the tools we use every day in the agency. Those, I might add, are our district plans, our maps, our mall plans, and through technology, upgrade the agency's ability to receive and transmit engineered documents from outside agencies that we're partnering with. And as a supervisor and director, this is most important to me as well. We will be able to restore employee professional development and training. And we will discontinue employee out-of-pocket expenses for agency business operation. So, bottom line, change item number one, or our initiative number one, is talking about the CAP Board being a full-time state agency in office, achieving balance between rising agency costs and increased volume of CAP Board projects. I'm going to ask Paul to go through items two and three on our list with you.
Madam Chair, Paul Mandel, Principal Planner for the CAP Board. The second item, the request was for $65,000 back in 1998. Through a bonding request, we were able to update our comprehensive plan and then the ensuing zoning ordinance for the first time in about 20 years. The state law that addressed and that forced us to, as well as every municipality that most of you probably live in if you're in the metropolitan area, required that, the comp plans be revisited and zoning ordinances upgraded every 10 years. So that time has come due now, and we do not have the wherewithal to handle this within our state, within our current budgets. We've estimated this at $65,000. Back in 98, we had a consultant work on the comprehensive plan, and then most of the zoning work was done by myself, with the assistance of the administrator, with the assistance of our AG, who fortunately don't charge our small agencies the cost, otherwise we wouldn't have been able to even do that. That zoning ordinance, because we're a state agency, goes through Administrative Procedures Act, so we have to eventually go to the administrative law judge, actually, for a hearing on that, and publish the necessary sonar, all the publications in state register, et cetera. We are asking for the $65,000 this time because what our plan is to do a sort of a check-in on our comprehensive plan, which is still pretty intact, but then to use some outside sources and peer review procedures, including working with the City of St. Paul, to assure that our zoning is a lot tighter than it was able to be made back in the late 90s. The third item is a language change. For the past three bienniums, in order, since we had gone part-time, we had language back in 1993 that enabled us to charge other public bodies for the extraordinary review when it's not in our normal scheme of things or program. For the past three bienniums, what we've had is language in law that allowed us to keep that money as a reimbursement. This year we were asking to have it made into part of our statute so it would be normal procedure, and the governor is supporting that. That way we're talking about usually somewhere between $3,000 and $10,000. It's not something that creates a huge pool or anything, but acts more as a reimbursement for those extraordinary circumstances. We were exceptionally busy during the past few years, of course, with all the state buildings that were being built, and that was not on our normal docket. So without that, we wouldn't have even been able to do what we do.
Madam Chair, I would ask you to look at the right-hand column, which now will reveal for you the governor's recommendation to our initiatives. On item number one, the governor is recommending $62,000 for the biennium additional to our budget, with a 2% increase of $15,000, which I think may be standard across the board for agencies. The $10,000 we were made aware of is in the budget of the Office of Enterprise Technology to upgrade our website, but I am not too clear on how that money would come forward into our budget for allocation. As Paul mentioned, item number two is not being funded or recommended for funding by the governor. It is my understanding that the thinking behind that is that the $77,000 in item number one would assume that we could do both our ordinary work within the agency as well as this special project for that amount of money. So therefore, the $65,000 was not funded. And as Paul just said, item number three, we are very pleased about because we will have that, or hopefully we will have that as a permanent language to our statute. The governor is recommending that.
I didn't get to look at the governor's bill yet, which we just submitted, but is the statutory change to that in the governor's bill? Do you know that?
I have not officially seen it in his bill, but we are told that he is recommending it to be.
I'm told that it is in it.
Yes.
Okay. And I just wanted to know if it was something that we had to submit a bill for, or was it already there? And I gather it's there. So
I think it's there. Okay, Madam Chair. So, in summary, does this restore the Cap Board to a full-time operating state agency, what the governor is allocating for us? And I will answer no. Nor does it allow the board to meet state law for item two. If we could secure the $65,000 needed to cover our zoning, we could be back at a full-time operating state agency. But again, the board's operations would continue to be lean and service to the public compromised. And I'm speaking about all of the other work that we have besides this zoning piece and the normal operations of the state. It puts our budget in a very tenuous position. We could return to full-time, but we will not have some of the many things that I was just telling you we need. So with that, Madam Chair and members, we thank you very much for this opportunity, and we welcome your questions.
I think I just heard you say that you don't think the services that you're going to get from the SMART process is going to help you very much. Do you think they're going to help you at all?
Madam Chair, we just learned of SMART around the middle part of January when the governor's recommendations came out. We do have a fiscal officer. Our fiscal officer does a certain amount of billings. I handle the HR within our office, but with limited funding over the last 4 years, we had no hiring. We had no letting go of people. We could not pay for unemployment. So the services that are being offered in SMART are minuscule to what the others, what all of us do within our agency. I might add that as a small agency, I think we have a good model in that we office with a larger agency in the administration department building, and we have shared in the services of their land connections, which is very vital to our operation. We also share in their equipment purchasing. So we are part of a larger entity and get a reasonable discount to equipment when we can afford it. So I think we've been smart about some of those efficiencies of combining in a near location with a larger agency.
Madam Chair, thank you. A couple of questions for Ms. Stark. Suppose this committee found a way to get you the appropriation you're asking for as opposed to the governor's recommendations. Would you still then be interested in a statutory change that would allow you to also capture receipts from fees?
Madam Chair, members, and Representative DeLaForest, yes, I do believe we would be, only because we would not want to go down the road as we have over the last 4 years and there be a similar budget crunch, and we would lose money from our budget. This is a fallback position for us, but as Paul said, it represents anywhere from I think about an average of $8,000 per year that we could bill for, and every little bit for us has helped.
And Madam Chair, thank you. And Ms. Stark, as you know, I'm a supporter of this board and think you do wonderful work. But I'm always a bit uncomfortable philosophically about this idea of state agency charging state agency for fees. It breeds all sorts of questions and inappropriate practices.
Point out, it's not just state agencies. It's also things who are, let them say that.
Right. Understood. Madam Chair, I only have a comment. Something maybe to look at. As I said, I will say readily to the committee, I think they do great work, and we should try to find a way to help them out and give them the resources they need. Madam Chair and Ms. Stark, I had one other question as well. You're a small board, and you had just alluded to a moment ago about some shared services and things. Why or why not, my question would be, why not be folded into a larger state agency that would allow you to take advantage of some economies of scale? For example, let somebody else do your human resources so you don't have to. And as I said, I merely ask that as a question. It's not a leading question. You know, tell me why you folks wouldn't want to be rolled into a larger agency, although I can anticipate a couple of your answers.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative DeLaForest. As I began my presentation, I noted that we were created by the legislature in 1967. We have, over the course of all of these years, brought forward budget requests specific for the Capitol building. We are considered independent. So if the governor does not make a recommendation as to our Capitol budget request, because we answer to the legislature, we can bring our request forward if you ask us. And so that's why we have stayed independent.
Madam Chair, if I might just also, with regard to the earlier question as to the language change, back in 93, the language in our statute was changed so that we can charge. The issue is not whether we can charge or not. The issue is whether it goes to general fund or whether it comes back as a reimbursement to the agency. And it's most applicable right now with all the planning being done for LRT. I mean, there's state law says that anytime there's federal dollars involved and we're asked to do something for a project federally funded, we have to charge. So,
If we're going through with this whole new capital renovation, isn't there some chance of taking some part of that budget? And you're obviously going to have greatly expanded amounts of work to do if that's going through. So.
Madam Chair, members, yes, it is always my agreement with the Department of Administration because, for the most part, the monies for projects within the capital area automatically go to the Department of Administration. I will do typically an estimate of what our charges. That is for staff time, primarily Paul and myself, for our three architectural advisors and for our board members, how many times we see a project coming back before the board for any kind of review, discussion, approval. We estimate for them what we will be charging, and those dollars are set aside out of their specific individual projects.
Any other questions? Do you know what the timeline for the proposal about the capital renovation is? Do you know what? Have bills been introduced or?
Madam Chair, members, we are aware that there is a bill that has been introduced in the Senate. At this point in time, I think it has been referred to Finance Committee. I do not know that a bill has been introduced in the House. And the author of the bill in the Senate is Senator Rest. And Senator Rest is one of our CAP Board members.
Okay. Any other questions, members? Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Sorry our scheduling didn't fill the day today, but I get to go to your offices early. Meeting adjourned.